This public radio podcast is supported by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to environmentally sound, energy efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson had some things to say about Wall Street. Today there was talk of new rules and regulations, but he started this way.
Thank you very much, and as I look around, I see a good number of friendly faces.
Because chances are he's going to need them from American public media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor. Online at FINRAFoundation.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday. It is the 26th of March today. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce was the setting for the Treasury Secretary's speech this morning. It was, as speeches about financial policy tend to be, dull. Important, but dull. So what we thought we'd do is take it apart, play the interesting bits for people who know something about the rules and regulations on Wall Street, and then see what they had to say about what he had to say. Secretary Paulson got to the point pretty quickly.
The circumstances that led the Fed to modify its lending facilities raises significant policy considerations that need to be addressed.
And then he set things up with a brief financial history lesson.
One distinction between banks and investment banks remains particularly important. Banks have the advantage that they issue deposits that are insured by the federal government. The trade-off for this subsidized funding is regulation tailored to protect the taxpayer from moral hazard this insurance creates.
That moral hazard argument we've all heard before, helping people who got in trouble by being greedy. But Duke University securities law professor James Cox heard something else, too.
I think that this is very problematic.
In what way?
That the investment banks will accept serious regulations of their ability to leverage themselves. This has been the key for many of their high returns of recent years. I don't think they give up that very easily.
Whether or not they will, Paulson went on to say he wants to make sure the Federal Reserve has a handle on exactly who it's lending money to.
The Federal Reserve should have the information about these institutions it deems necessary for making informed lending decisions. The Federal Reserve is currently working to ensure the adequacy of such information.
Eric Talley is a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley.
That snippet of the speech is a multisyllabic version of "we're making this up as we go along."
Making it up because the truth is nobody is specifically in charge of regulating the investment banks that caused the credit crunch that got us to where we are. Hillary Sale teaches corporate and securities law at the University of Iowa.
What I thought was interesting about his language was that these people or these institutions should consider, to be distinguished from the administration actually saying, go do it.
Secretary Paulson went on to talk a while about the real estate market, but before he did, he took a minute to snap Wall Street right back to reality.
Despite the fundamental changes in our financial system, it would be premature to jump to the conclusion that all broker-dealers or other potentially important financial firms in our system today should have permanent access to the Fed's liquidity facility.
Duke's Jim Cox gets the last word on the speech today.
I thought what we were trying to do is to provide knowledge of a safety net so everybody had confidence in the financial system. Now I'm sort of wondering if we're not lowering that safety net a little closer to the ground.
Wall Street's recent angst has only emphasized the economy's place at the center of the election debate. Earlier this week, Hillary Clinton called on the government to do more to help homeowners. Yesterday, John McCain warned against too much government action. And today, Barack Obama said McCain doesn't know what he's talking about. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser to look into whether any of them do.
I want to help keep people in their homes.
The government has a number of tools at its disposal.
It's not the duty of government to bail out and reward those who act irresponsibly.
But Desmond Lachman, an American Enterprise Institute fellow, says even the $30 billion that Clinton proposed wouldn't do it. And he says ducking the problem entirely won't work either.
I don't think that they've grasped the magnitude of the problem and how long-lasting it's going to be.
So do any of the candidates know what they're talking about?
Well, that's always a dangerous question.
University of Texas economist James Galbraith told me the candidates are pretty vague, and that's because they have no idea what they'd face as president.
A lot of things would have to be negotiated, and you'll get a policy that emerges at the end of the day from a process.
And they're a bit shy about making promises. Remember this?
Read my lips.
Berkeley economist Brad DeLong says the elder President Bush was foolish to promise no new taxes, something he couldn't deliver.
Lots of candidates have learned from that.
But that won't stop the candidates from talking economics anytime soon. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Today, Senate Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd invited Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and Secretary Paulson to come on up to Capitol Hill sometime real soon. Dodd's got his name on a plan to ease the mortgage crisis. Commentator Robert Reich points out the bill addresses another issue, too, whether taxpayers who pick up the tab for bailouts should profit if the gamble pays off.
Such a deal. Bear Stearns shareholders get $10 a share instead of the $2 they thought they were going to get because J.P. Morgan raised its offer. And why did J.P. raise its offer? Because it wants Bear's assets, theoretically valued at $30 billion, but worth less than that because they contain some junk loans that can't be collected on. But, of course, nobody knows how many bad loans, so J.P. is placing a big bet. But it's not really that risky a bet, because if Bear's assets contain more than $1 billion of junk, the Fed makes up the difference, which means you and I and every other taxpayer take a hit. If this bet pays off, J.P. Morgan shareholders make a bundle. If it doesn't, they still may make lots of money, but we lose. At least when Britain bailed out its biggest bank, the government took its shares of stock. So British taxpayers get any upside gain if and when the shares are worth something again. But here in the good old U.S. of A., we believe in socialized capitalism, which means private investors reap the gains and taxpayers take the losses. When Congress returns next week, they'll be voting on a plan that gives taxpayers some of the upside gains. The emerging Dodd-Frank bill would backstop investors who buy securities containing risky mortgage debts as long as the investors restructure them to give homeowners a better chance of repaying. Yes, taxpayers bear the downside risk here, but if these securities become more valuable because homeowners in fact do repay, we share in the profits. Now, this makes much more sense than the Fed's bank bailouts. Our credit markets are a mess because it's anybody's bet how many bad loans are out there. But if government's going to clean up this mess, American taxpayers should get a portion of the profits on bets that turn out good in order to compensate us for bets that turn out bad. The idea is as American as apple pie. Nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book is called Super Capitalism. There was a whole bunch of capitalism on Wall Street today. Not much of it on the upside, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you were trying to get anywhere on American Airlines today, you already know this, but some unscheduled maintenance did a number on its flight schedule. American canceled about 300 flights, 10% or so, to double-check wiring on some of its MD-80 airplanes. The inspections were prompted after an audit by the airline and the Federal Aviation Administration. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more now on the aging skies.
The MD-80 aircraft is a short-haul workhorse that makes up almost half of the American Airlines fleet. University of Portland, Oregon finance professor Richard Gritta just flew home on one. Was he at all worried about his safety?
I'm not. You know, if your number's up, your number's up, my sainted grandmother would say.
The MD-80s tend to be older planes, but Gritta says age isn't the issue.
If you have older fleets, the planes are still safe. It's just that they require more inspections. I mean, theoretically, properly maintained, an airframe can go forever.
Newer model aircraft are less expensive to operate, but with the high cost of oil and other economic pressures, few airlines are in a position to upgrade. Instead, they are milking every mile from existing fleets. Grida says that's okay as long as the planes get proper inspections. Vahid Montevalli is director of the Aviation Institute at George Washington University. He says the FAA may not have the manpower to carry out those checks.
The overall problem is that with budget cuts in recent years, we have a shortage of FAA inspectors, and therefore the oversight is also being stretched to its limit. And so some of these perhaps lower priority inspections may be overlooked or fall to the side.
The issue may surface during congressional hearings next week. Legislators are looking into the cozy relationship between the FAA and the airlines and any impact that might have on safety. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Go ahead and chalk up another one for activist investor Carl Icahn. He's been after Motorola to split itself in two, cell phones in one corner, two-way radios, set-top boxes, and wireless equipment in the other. He got his way today. Of course, it didn't hurt his cause that Motorola shares have been trading at five-year lows. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli looked into whether the split might actually turn things around.
With revenue up on one side of the business and profits down on the other, you might understand why Motorola would want to break itself in two.
Motorola is in a lifeboat in some very, very stormy seas right now. And what they've just done is they've just grabbed the mobile devices guy and thrown him overboard.
That's mobile industry analyst Ian Gillett. He says he doesn't think the split is the wisest strategy, given how connected the two divisions are, and given the current sour mood at Motorola's cell phone business, with a revolving door of executives and tanking sales.
If you're going to spin it out, then you want it to have some momentum. You want new product. You want, you know, excited employees. You haven't got any of that.
At least not since Motorola's once red-hot product, the Razr, got dull. And there were no follow-up phone successes in the wings. But Mark Frieser of communications firm IDT says for the company that made the first mobile phone, a split might be just the ticket.
It will allow the handset manufacturers to concentrate on what it is the consumers and the carriers want.
Forrester analyst Ellen Daly says in the end, there's really just one main reason for breaking Motorola into two separate companies.
The spinoff is really to, I think, give relief to the shareholders.
And those are the people who've really got Motorola's number. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
In Iraq today, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki gave Shiite insurgents in the southern city of Basra 72 hours to stop the violence. The New York Times says 40 people have died, 200 have been wounded in fighting in Basra and Baghdad that started yesterday. It's not clear if any of those casualties are civilian contractors, but the death toll for them is rising. Last year, the number of civilian contractors killed in Iraq rose 17%. Not all of them were American, though. Private security firms are increasingly using third-country nationals to support the war, as Gretchen Wilson reports from Namibia.
Namibia's war for independence ended 20 years ago, but Alex Kamwe still likes to dress up in fatigues and recall his years as a battalion commander.
The comrades have been shot. I have to pick the gun and try to see how I can move that colleague, and then we move.
Kamwe's the head of the Namibia Ex-Freedom Fighters and War Veterans Association. He says former soldiers in Namibia have few marketable skills.
Our economic situation as veterans, it's very, very poor.
So when an American private security company put help wanted ads in local papers last September, hundreds of Namibians lined up. The job? Non-combat security guards to work in Iraq and Afghanistan.
They were really rushing in large numbers to get jobs because they are suffering.
The U.S. Defense Department says 30% of contract personnel in Iraq are so-called third-country nationals, brought in to support U.S.-led efforts. They guard convoys, bridges, and pipelines. Doug Brooks heads the International Peace Operations Association, a trade group for private security companies. He says Africans have valuable experience of conflict.
So they have some knowledge about risk mitigation. What is risky in a war zone? And most people in the world don't know what this is. People in Africa do, and they have this amazing amount of experience that they bring to their jobs.
Of course, there's another reason U.S. contractors like hiring Africans.
They tend to be much cheaper than Americans or Westerners, and maybe by a factor of 5 or 6. You know, should the U.S. government only hire Americans to do these sorts of jobs, the cost would be just insane.
But what's cheap for Western firms is gravy in Africa. In Namibia, some war zone jobs pay $600 a month. That's 10 times what a local security guard can earn.
Which is a lot of money for them. Now, they're willing to take a certain degree of risk to earn that money, and for them it can mean the survival of their families. So as long as they have a choice, if they're allowed to do this kind of work, you'll get a lot of people willing to do it.
What is really the choice? When somebody is poor and is trapped in this poverty, what choice do they have or can make?
Phil Yanangolo heads the National Society for Human Rights in Namibia's capital, Windhoek. He says recruiting companies can exploit the desperately poor and uneducated.
Some of them do not have even access to newspapers or television to know what is going on there with suicide bombers. They are not aware of this.
Suicide bombers aren't the only potential hazard for third country nationals. Africans also risk labor and other rights abuses. Amnesty International reports cases in which companies have taken away passports or delivered new hires to unexpected locations. Concerns about abuse by these companies boil over in Namibia in September, when a Nevada-based private security firm called SOC-SMG started recruiting. Namibians need jobs, but when news spread about the risks they'd face in Iraq, there was public outcry. In October, Namibia kicked the company's officials out of the country. Former soldier Alex Kamwi worked as a consultant for SOC-SMG before the blow-up, but as the father of 10 started to learn more about Iraq, he started to question the company.
Are you sure these people will come back safe? And that question, which was worrying me, was also worrying government, was also worrying anyone in this country.
SOC-SMG wouldn't speak to Marketplace for the story, but in an email, it said it had been in Namibia with the approval of the government and the U.S. Embassy, and it intended to comply with local laws. In November, South Africa became the first African country to effectively block all such recruitment. But today, U.S. companies are looking for new hires in many African countries, such as Angola, Uganda, and Mozambique. In Windhoek, Namibia, I'm Gretchen Wilson from Marketplace.
Coming up, a video game that makes you feel good.
Even more remarkable is the employees playing the game were rated as more self-confident. And then, moreover, they actually made more sales.
But first, let's do the numbers. A drop in durable goods orders, a surge in oil prices, a gloomy forecast for bank profits, all of it led to a down day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials lost 0.8%, 109 points, to close at 12,422. The NASDAQ gave back 0.7%, 16 points, closed at 2324. The S&P 500 stumbled 0.8%, 11 points, ended the day at 1341 there. We told you about Motorola's plans to spin off its handset business. That connected with investors. Shares dialed up a 2.75% gain. Citigroup led the decline among financials after an Oppenheimer & Company analyst downgraded the whole sector. News that the banking giant could lose $1.15 a share in the first quarter sent its stock reeling almost 6% lower. Clear Channel Communications picked up a whole lot of static after news that a private equity buyout of the media company is on the brink of collapse. Its shares tuned out more than 17% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.47%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888 Vanguard. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over 1 billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
from the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the fourth quarter gross domestic product report. President Bush visits the National Museum of the Air Force in Dayton, Ohio, where he'll speak on the war on terror. And sushi chefs from around the world gather in Tokyo for the Japanese Restaurant International Forum. They'll look at problems faced in each region as Japanese food gains global popularity. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You get sick in this country, a remedy is usually not too far away. The pharmaceutical industry has tried to help with that. So has Congress. Federal laws passed more than a decade ago encourage the development of leading-edge drugs. They also contain a way to get them on the market faster. Some of them, though, didn't work out that well. Anybody remember Vioxx? A study out today says that fast-track process does compromise safety. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
Say you're diagnosed with cancer, and there's a breakthrough drug that doctors think could save you. You'd want it right away. Well, the fast-track laws enacted in 1992 let the FDA speed up the approval process to just 6 months. But the study found that fast-track FDA decisions can cause trouble later on.
These decisions are much more likely to result in drug withdrawals or new safety problems that were not anticipated.
Dr. Jerry Avorn at Harvard Medical School co-authored the paper. It'll be published in the New England Journal of Medicine. He says fast-track drugs get recalled 5 times more often than standard drugs. But the FDA has a problem with the Harvard team's data. Here's the agency's Clark Nardinelli.
We tried to replicate what they did, and we came out with very different numbers, which led us to think that their conclusions don't hold up.
Avorn stands by his data. He says what doesn't hold up is the FDA's funding model.
About half of the budget for FDA's scientists who review drugs does indeed come from the drug industry.
The authors say that creates the sense that the FDA works for big pharma and calls into question why some drugs like Vioxx are fast-tracked and others aren't. Analyst Les Funtleiter at Miller Tabak hopes the study won't slow down the approval process.
The issue isn't so much that we need more regulation, it's that the FDA needs more staff.
The FDA said today it does not approve drugs before they're ready. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The world's biggest video game maker took a bit of a hit today. Management at Take-Two Interactive told its shareholders to reject a $2 billion buyout offer from industry leader Electronic Arts. But Take-Two did say that if EA bumps its offer up some, you know, we could talk. There has, of course, been a lot of discussion about whether video games are bad for you. And there's been some research into whether they might actually be good for you, too. A game called Mind Habits could be one of the good ones. Marketplace's Sean Cole has our story.
About 5 years ago, a McGill psychology professor named Mark Baldwin was chewing on a problem with his grad students. They knew that stress was often a reaction to social threat. Insecure thoughts, like, are they laughing at me?
And it turns out a lot of these thought processes happen in a split second.
So, how do you change thought processes that happen in a split second?
And we thought of the game Tetris, you know, where you fit the blocks into the spaces.
It's hard at first, but after a while, your brain gets trained.
So we thought, okay, can we design a video game that will help people practice positive patterns of thought?
The game was basic in the beginning. 16 faces in a grid.
15 of them are scowling at you, and they're quite critical and rejecting. One of them is smiling warmly, and you just have to find the one smiling face over and over and over again.
They tested it out on a bunch of telemarketers.
We needed to find a group that was very stressed, and You know, I always hang up on telemarketers, frankly, personally. So they're dealing with a lot of rejection all day long.
But after playing the game 5 minutes a day for a week, something incredible happened. The level of cortisol, or the stress hormone, in their bodies had dropped by 17%.
Even more remarkable is the employees playing the game were rated as more self-confident. And then, moreover, they actually made more sales.
And that's pretty much how Mind Habits was born. The commercial version is a lot more complicated, much more of a game. The faces appear in a series of flipping boxes now, and there are more smiling ones. The package comes with a few other games, too. One of them is supposed to make you feel good about yourself by flashing a smiling picture when you click on your name. There's a word search game with words like compassion and friend. Baldwin says just thinking about those concepts can make you feel better. You can play the demo version for free on the Mind Habits website or download the full version for $19.99.
Did you intend at the outset to become entrepreneurs?
No.
And money wasn't the chief motivator. Mainly, Baldwin really wanted more people to learn about his research.
Often when we do research in the lab, it doesn't get that far away from the lab. So partly I wanted to say, how can we get this thing out there so people can try it for themselves? And it costs money. And the only way to get the money to do it, really, is to make it a business.
That's so funny. I automatically started to click on the frowning face.
I tried Mind Habits out for myself, starting with the game where you click on the smiles. It got pretty difficult.
Oh, wow. Oh, hey. I go to click, but it flips. This is not fair. This is frustrating. I'm feeling very stressed.
It's actually adjusted to your own speed, so...
But it's also pretty fun. In fact, Mind Habits beat out 69 other contenders in the Great Canadian Video Game Competition last year, which meant $1.3 million and a lot of credibility. Maybe in part because it fits into this hot genre called casual games, which just means games you play when you have a little downtime here and there. A lot of middle-aged women are playing them. And believe it or not...
That's really the fastest-growing demographic right now, is the middle-aged women.
Jeffrey Zatkin is president of Electronic Entertainment Design and Research. He analyzes the revenue potential of video games before they're built. He says kids haven't made up the majority of the gaming market for years.
Everybody who started playing video games when they were young, most of them kept playing. The average age of the gamer is now in their young 30s.
Like me, or youngish 30s. Except I did stop playing video games as a kid, but Mind Habits is hard to break. And I couldn't make it out of the interview with Mark Baldwin before playing one more time.
I'm doing good now. I'm hot.
Staring into a computer screen in Montreal, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
All right, yeah. I'm a clicking machine.
You can play if you want. There's a link on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today on how quickly things change. A year ago, the books we got here at Marketplace were mostly of the read this and we can make you rich variety. Find it, fix it, flip it, make millions in real estate one house at a time was very popular. Next year's crop is all about helping us survive these turbulent economic times. We spotted this item in the Los Angeles Times today, that publishers are scrambling to cash in on the downtrend in the economy with titles like Game Over, How the Collapsing Economy Will Shrink Your Wealth by 50% Unless You Know What to Do. Probably by buying that book, right? That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 109.8 tenths of 1%. The Nasdaq lost 16.7 tenths percent. The S&P 500 fell 11.8 tenths percent there. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, school fight songs have music publishers humming a happy tune.
And that's always the hope, is that you unearth a jewel that turns out to be valuable to you.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.